The honor of Crab Rangoon's crust was upheld that morning at Alden Hall, prompting a rueful Sionji to remark that his technique must really have slipped if he could lose his rose to Kaworu of all people. Tenjo, understandably, he remarked with a dry smile. She is clearly my superior in every measurable way, but you? He shook his head sadly. Uten isn't your superior in every way, Miki said mildly. Hey! Uten protested with mock indignation. You'll never be taller than he is, Miki pointed out, and both Utena and Sionji had to admit he had a point. Caitlin managed to track down Edward around mid-morning. The hacker was very distracted and starting to look a bit worn down, but insisted that the Durandal project was going very well, and that she and Ayn were holding up nicely, thank you for asking. She further agreed cheerfully to the loan of her SimSense deck, since she wouldn't be needing it. She preferred to use more conventional systems for the important stuff, and she was much too busy with Durandal to go playing around with SimSense interface this month anyway. So Kate set the deck up on her desk, patched it into her data terminal's network feed, seated herself comfortably in her chair, and affixed the adhesive electrodes to her head and hands. This would be easier if I had a neuroprocessor, Kate explained to Utena. And someday I'll have to get one. But this will do for now. Utena nodded, suppressing a bit of a shiver. Out of all the strange things she'd had to get used to about this world, the notion that people went around routinely having computer equipment implanted in their bodies still just plain gave her the creeps. Amanda Dessler had one. It was part of the control system of her space fighter, absolutely essential for the career path she was on in the Gamelon Navy. Kate's father had one too, or so she'd heard. Why he seemed to wear a Vambrace computer all the time if he had a neuroprocessor, Utena wasn't sure, but she didn't really want to think about it too much. Megazone was reputed to be a veritable hardware store, more machine than man, but she wasn't sure she believed that. This'll probably take a half hour or so, Kate went on, fitting the padded blindfold across her eyes. Try not to bump my chair, she added with a grin. Good luck, said Utena, the sentiment echoed by Corwin and Nall. Kate thanked them, took a slightly deeper than normal breath, and then pressed the go key. It blinked three times, then glowed steady green, and Kate relaxed a little in the chair, her partly obscured face going blank. That is so weird, Utena murmured. Corwin agreed. It has its uses, though. Utena crossed the room and sat down in Kate's usual armchair, since Corwin was in hers. I keep expecting to see her acting out what she's doing, she said after a few minutes. The early systems, people did. That was before they figured out motor interdict and just read the signals instead of intercepting them. So she's helpless right now? Pretty much. You could walk up and do damn near anything, and she wouldn't notice. About the only thing that can break the connection from outside, except for unplugging or shutting off the deck, is bright light. The optic nerve is a powerful thing. That's why the blindfold. She can't hear us, though. Wouldn't feel it if we touched her. Brr. I could never do that to myself. Make myself so defenseless. Not unless it was someone I really trusted watching my back. Neither could Kate, Nall pointed out. Utena mused. Tiny Robo and Lesser Mazinger stood on Kate's desk, watching her. Utena was suddenly startled, then amused, to see that Lesser Mazinger had one of his swords out and was holding it at the ready, looking rather comically like a tiny executioner. At the slightest sign of discomfort from his mistress, the robot was prepared to sever the cable leading to the electrodes that held her mind in thrall to the illusory reality of the Avalon County Department of Motor Vehicles. She caught Corwin's eye and directed his attention thither. He noted it, cocked an eyebrow, and grinned. "His protector teen's stronger than I expected," he said. "That's a pretty sophisticated piece of logic for an AI his size, figuring out that cutting that wire would help her if she ran into trouble. Not that there's any chance she will. It's an authorized program from the DMV, not a raid on the As Technology payroll database. Still, it's nice to see he's tending to business." Utrina smiled. "They're both like that. Tiny Robo followed me halfway across town last weekend in a snowstorm to make sure I was okay. Which reminds me," she said, partly because it did and partly to change the subject, before he asked for an explanation of what had gone wrong that weekend, "I haven't thanked you lately for him, or my sword. They've both served me very well." Corwin grinned again, slightly abashed. "I'm glad they're working out for you," he said. "And I'm sorry I missed your duel with Liza Broadbitch. Damn, I'm sorry I missed that." "Me too," said Noll. "After the hurting you laid on Dad, I was hoping Liza'd lose an arm." Utrin chuckled. "Dad?" "Well, yeah. Me and Corwin, we're like brothers, you know," said the dragon importantly, drawing himself up. Utrin supposed he had a point. A little while later, Kate stiffened a little, almost making Lesser Rosinger cut the wire, before she shook herself, reached out, and flicked the stop switch. Then she flipped up the blindfold, peeled off the trodes, and turned to her roommate and the others, grinning broadly. "I passed. I got my license." "All right," Corwin declared, jumping up and grabbing her up in a hug. "Way to go, Kate." Utina joined in, seizing both siblings at once. The printer next to Kate's terminal beeped, chuntered, beeped again, and then spat out a freshly minted, holographically sealed, micro-encoded Avalon County driver's license, complete with an honest-to-God decent little hollow of her smiling, spectacled face. Utina grabbed it out of the slot, admired it, then passed it to Corwin so that he could do the same before bestowing it with a flourish on its owner. "So when are you taking your master's cert exam?" Corwin asked with a grin. Kate rolled her eyes and whacked him on the shoulder. "Get real. After high school, I'm sure. Probably after college." They spent the next hour rounding up whoever they could find for a mass exodus down the hill, where they took over nearly the entirety of Boomer's Pizza to enjoy the somewhat surly service and the unusually thick for Worcester pizza. As such critical masses often do, this group broke up again on the way up the hill, leaving the same foursome wondering what to do with themselves as they climbed the hill again.
"Let's go bowling," Kate suggested as they reached West Street and entered the campus proper.
"That sounds like fun," Corwin said.
"I don't think I've ever been bowling," Utrina noted.
"Me neither," Noll said. "I've tried, but they never have shoes in my size."
"Hey, there's Jury," Kate observed, seeing the tall redhead emerging from the wedge as they approached Corwin's car, parked in its usual spot by the quad. Utina duly hailed her. Jury looked up at the sound of her name, then crossed to them, her face questioning.
"Kate got her driver's license," said Utina, her arm around her roommate's shoulders, "and now she wants to go bowling. You want to come with?"
Jury smiled a little slyly, though no one with her could quite fathom why she should have a sly smile about bowling, of all things.
"That sounds like it could be fun," she said.
"I guess we're off to Shrewsbury Lanes," Kate said to Corwin.
"The Institute handbook mentions a bowling alley on campus," Jury noted.
"I've heard this rant," said Utina preemptively. "The campus lanes aren't the right width or length or something."
Length, Kate confirmed. Too short.
Jury frowned.
"Well, that will never do," she agreed.
"Let's go."
They piled into Corwin's car. With a smile and a flourish, he handed over the keys to his newly licensed sister, and she showed her prowess in getting the long, powerful beast down Route 9 without a hitch.
"Hey, Corwin," Utrina said over her shoulder.
"Yeah?"
Corwin replied, leaning forward a bit in the back seat. I've only ever driven automatics, she said, pointing to the gear shift lever. Kate was currently shifting into third. Can you teach me how to drive one of these? No trouble at all, Corwin replied without hesitation. Love to. Maybe over break? The first week I've still got classes, but the second week Crescent Heights is off, too. Sounds good to me. What do you say, Kate? Toronto the first week, then back here the second? Kate nodded. Works for me. As he sat back, almost glowing with anticipation, Corwin wondered why the hell the redhead was giving him such a sour look. 6 games later, Caitlin admitted that Jury's Kung Fu was best, then bought her a milkshake. You're a ringer, she accused the redhead jokingly, as she returned from the Shrewsbury Lane soda counter and distributed the beverages. Two perfect games out of six? Lowest score 200 and... She shook her head. Ringer. Jury nodded modestly. I've been bowling since I was 7. I guess I have a natural aptitude for it. She gave her shoes a distasteful look and added, even in rented shoes. So buy good ones, said Utana, grinning. You're rich. Jury gave her an odd look, then laughed. I suppose I am, she replied. Your friend is a strange one, Tenjo. Next time, Kate insisted, video games again. I owned you at Street Fighter. Once I hit my stride on this world's games, Jury replied with cool, half-serious detachment, you won't be able to beat me there either. We'll damn well see about that, Kate replied, but she was smiling. I hope so, Null remarked, yawning. Video games are exciting. There's nothing as boring to watch as a good bowler. Kate makes up for that, said Corwin, earning a punch in the arm. It was true. Kate was an enthusiastic but mediocre bowler, without much in the way of consistency. She certainly enjoyed the game, though, even if she wasn't very good at it. Enough that, now that she knew she'd found willing opponents in Jury and Utana and Corwin when he was around, she encouraged Utana's half-joking suggestion of a visit to the Lane's Pro Shop. By the time they left, each of the 4 humans had a pair of shoes and a bowling ball, and had put 2 games on each. Dad's going to be confused as hell, Corwin mused as he put his newly acquired bowling bag in the trunk of his car. He'll probably think it's a bomb or something. Anything but what it looks like. Kate laughed and slid back behind the wheel. Tell him it's my fault, she said. Corwin actually seemed to remember his ostensible mission for his frequent trips to Worcester that evening. When they returned to campus from their bowling expedition, he took Dorothy for a starlit walk around the school and its environs, anxious to hear how she was faring with the school experience, especially the unexpected twist of having a roommate. She didn't seem all that different at first glance, but inside she was changing, and Corwin rejoiced to discover the differences as she spoke to him. They went up to Bancroft Tower and sat in one of the mini-turrets flanking the walkway, discussing her impressions of the school, her new friends, the good and bad times. As sometimes happened when she spoke to him, Dorothy put aside her robotic reserve and warmed to the topic. "Jury would like you to teach me to sleep," Dorothy observed during the part of the talk that focused on her new rooming situation. "Sleep?" Corwin inquired, blinking. "Yes. I don't, of course. And she says it's distracting to know that I'm hovering around awake all the time, even though I don't make noise. She says if I'm human enough to forget class assignments, I should be human enough to sleep. Do you think she's right?" Corwin was gazing at her with a look that said, "I'm an idiot." "You don't sleep?" he said. "No. Didn't you know that?" "No," Corwin replied, slapping his forehead. "I just assumed you weren't sleeping when I crashed in your room because you made me take the bed and didn't want to sleep on the floor. That's why I tried to talk you out of it the first time." "I couldn't let you sleep on the floor," Dorothy remonstrated with gentle irony. "The first law..." "Oh, slag the first law," Corwin grumbled, and wondered why that brought a tiny smile to her lips. "You really don't sleep, and I never noticed. What an idiot I am." "Well, I think Jury's right. Your positronic matrix is sophisticated enough that if you compose yourself properly, you ought to enter a relaxed consciousness trance that's like sleep, anyway. I mean, scientists don't even really know what sleep is, even today." She nodded. "Interesting. I'll try it tonight." "Let me know how it comes out," he said, and she nodded again. "Do you think I will dream?" she asked. Corwin cocked his head, fought down the obvious joke, and said honestly, "I don't know. But when you find out, I'd love to know." "All right," said Dorothy. "Listen, do you have any idea why Jury would be mad at me?" "Mad? As in angry with you?" He nodded. "No," Dorothy said after a moment's thought. "If she were displeased with me as her roommate, she might take it out on you as my owner, but she gives no indication, other than being annoyed by my lack of sleeping habits, that she's dissatisfied in any way." "It's hard to tell with Jury," she went on, unconscious of the irony, "but I think she might even like me." Corwin thought that over. I wonder what's the matter then. 'Cause she sure gives me the impression that she doesn't like me. She tries to hide it, I think, but sometimes I catch her giving me these looks. "That may simply be Jury being Jury," Dorothy told him. "Her neutral expression is one that humans often mistake for a sign of personal displeasure."
"You mean she scowls like that all the time?"
"That's what I said."
"Huh. Well, I wonder, all the same, it feels like there's something personal in it, and I'm damned if I know what."
Their conversation diverged from there, and when they returned to the school an hour or so later, she had an air of satisfaction, he aglow like a parent's pride. At her door, still not repaired, he gave her a hug, entirely unconcerned while she returned it, that she could crush a concrete block in her arms if she cared to. Dorothy's embraces, like every other personal contact she made, were measured and precise, satisfyingly firm without the slightest hint of danger or discomfort. Then he kissed her on the forehead, raising that little blush in her cheeks again, and told her to have a good night and sleep well. He turned from her door to see Janice, the resident advisor from 411. Why could he never remember her last name? Regarding him with a speculative look.
"What?" he inquired. "Curfew violation?"
"Nah," Janice replied. "I just never saw anybody treat a robot like that before. It's cute. You going to sponsor her for touring?"
"I've done it every year for the past 3, Corwin replied. "She keeps not going."
"Huh.
Weird. Well, who can figure, right? Listen, you're not going to crash with your sister, are you? I don't care, particularly, but Res Services could raise all hell if they found out, and I think at least one of Liza B's snitches lives on this floor."
"Nah, I'm going down to Institute."
Bunking with Bishonen boy, huh?"
Corwin suppressed a snicker and wondered, not for the first time, about the etymology of that word.
"It was either that or lunch counter, lad," Janice explained with a shrug. "Well, good night."
"Night," said Corwin, and the RA went back into her room. Corwin shook his head, smiling to himself, and knocked on the door of 412. Its denizens were already in their pajamas, ready for an early night before they tackled the first of their finals in the morning.
"God, Kate, those pajamas.
said Corwin with an indulgent chuckle, pretending to shield his eyes from their tiger-striped glory.
I could be wearing the set Aunt Belle made, Kate pointed out.
With the feet and the head? Corwin asked. She nodded and he laughed. Oh, wow, I'd forgotten about those. I should get her to make you a new set. You'd be so cute.
Utna looked puzzled.
Kate explained, when I was 10, Aunt Belle made me a set of pajamas that looked like a tiger. It had paws and a tail.
And a hood with a snout, eyes, and ears, Corwin reminded her. Can't forget that.
No, Kate replied with a sigh. No one ever can.
Utna had to sit down on her bed. She was so tickled by the mental image.
Oh, wow, Kate, she said when she got her breath back. Corwin, you have got to get your aunt to make another one of those. I just have to see it.
I'll see what I can do, Corwin promised. Kate folded her arms and pretended to scowl, but it was obvious her heart wasn't in it.
Anyway, I gotta run, said Corwin. Sionji's got finals, too, and I promised I'd get down to Institute before he goes to bed, so he can get a solid night's sleep.
Do that, Kate agreed. First finals at the Institute are important, especially if you test it in. He needs to do as well as he can.
Corwin had the door open to go, but neither girl would let him leave without a hug. Nal took the opportunity to jump ship again, giving Corwin a big cheese-eating grin, but Corwin only brushed it off with an air of resignation.
Fine, see you in the morning, Oathbreaker, he said. Nal just stuck out his little red tongue.
We're egg-bonded, Pink Boy, not married, he said.
Rules, lawyer, said Corwin with a smile. Good night, you guys. I'll see you at breakfast, and then the furball and I are out of here to let you face your finals.
He went off down the hall, whistling a little tune. Behind him, Juri Arisugawa crossed the hallway and put her head into 412 before Kate could close the door.
I want a word with you, Tencho, she said. In private. Now.
Utna, puzzled, put Nal on Kate's bed and followed Juri over to 413. What was eating her? She hadn't been that peremptory since back in the bad old days.
Take off this ring and leave the academy. Yes, ma'am, how fast would you like that?
Sheesh.
Utna had been hoping maybe the redhead had mellowed at least a little. She passed Dorothy in the doorway of room 413. The robot gave her a slightly puzzled look and an infinitesimal shrug in response to her own querying expression, then went to wait in the hall.
Okay, said Utna, closing the door as best as it would close behind her.
What?
Have you forgotten the cause that brought us all together in your pursuit of the raven hair boy?
Juri asked her.
Utna blinked. What? She managed to ask after a few moments.
Don't play dumb with me. I've seen the looks the two of you give each other. I know the signs. Have you already forgotten the Rose Bride?
Utna flushed.
That's going too far, Juri, she snapped. What are you insinuating, that I'm screwing around with Kate's brother? Ah, to hell with him, Emiya. She's not here anyway. Might as well have some fun?
Something like that, Juri replied dryly.
Well, for your information, Miss Judgmental, I'm not. Corwin is my friend, okay? My very good friend. He's a good kid, he's fun to be around, and we have a lot of common interests.
Including, Juri put in, each other.
Will you stop that? What the hell is your problem?
My problem is being brought here, Juri replied, to see you apparently forgetting everything you fought the tournament for.
Utna adopted an exaggeratedly thoughtful expression. You know, Juri, I've been having some trouble with my short-term memory lately. Could you be a pal and maybe remind me exactly when the hell I asked for your opinion? Anyway, where do you get off assuming you even know what I fought for? Himimbi and I never figured out if we were, because I'm not usually, and there wasn't time to... Utina stopped, realizing she was never going to get all that articulated in anything like a timely manner, regrouped, thought of a different facet of Juri's assumptions that annoyed her, and launched herself after that one instead. Besides, damn it, Corwin happens to be 13, okay? He's the same age as Miki, so not only do you think I'm a promise breaker and a betrayer, but a cradle robber too? Go to hell! You know why I won the tournament? Because I'm not that fucked up! Then she spun on her heel, stormed out of the room, and slammed the broken door behind her. A few moments later, Janice the RA put her head around the edge of the door, which, not being lockable, had sprung back open from the force of the slam. Sounds like that could have gone better, she observed dryly. You want to pick your next fight someplace else, please? We've got people trying to study for finals around here. Like, oh, say, me. She gave Juri a thoughtful look. You know, I don't remember seeing you around before that morning a couple weeks ago. Are you even a student? No, Juri replied flatly, not in any mood to quibble. Janice took that in, then shrugged. Whatever. Not my job to chase out squatters. Just don't break anything and keep the noise down, huh? I'll try, said Juri shortly. Good, good, said Janice. Noticing the broken lock on the door, she inquired, do you guys want me to file a maintenance request for this, or... At the scowl Juri leveled at her, she sighed. Okay, forget it, she said, and went back to her own room, shaking her head with resignation at the perversity of the world. Why are the hot ones always so damn bitchy? Dorothy waited for her to go, then re-entered room 413. Don't say anything, said Juri. Dorothy looked curiously at her for a moment, then went and got into bed. I'm going to try to sleep, she reported. Good night. Good night, Juri told her. I'm going out for a while. She pulled on her coat and boots and strode off down the hall. Juri got as far as the hallway leading from the wedge to Institute Road past the commuting student lockers, then found her path blocked by a small form with arms folded. You're not going to go bother Corwin, too, Azalyn told her flatly. Juri pulled up short, startled and a bit impressed by the Dantrovian's air of bald challenge. Get out of my way, she said. No, Azalyn replied. I said you're not bothering Corwin, and I meant it. Stay away from him if you can't mind your own business. Which of us is the pot and which the kettle? Juri inquired caustically, hands on hips. Don't be cute, Azalyn replied. It doesn't suit you. This is my business. My friend's happiness is my business, and you're screwing around with it. The Dantrovian's golden eyes narrowed. I don't like that. You don't understand the situation, Juri said. Sure I do, Azalyn replied. You think because Utina likes Corwin, that means she's abandoning Anthe. Juri blinked. How did... She hasn't... No, she hasn't. She doesn't even know I know. I heard it from Sionji while I was putting his mind back together after your pal the deputy chairman got done with it. Don't you people ever talk to each other? He and I and Miki sorted all of this out before you got here, and neither one of them brought you up to date? I swear, I have to do everything around here. But that's all beside the point. You think what I said, right? Isn't it obvious? Azalyn shook her head. Only to someone as limited as you apparently are, she replied. You call her your friend and berate her for feeling the warmth of another's presence in her heart? What kind of hypocrite are you? And what were you planning to do next? Go wake up Corwin and Sionji? Throw Sionji out of his room into the hall on the night before finals and then tell Corwin to stay away from Utina? Something like that, Juri admitted. Don't be an idiot, Azalyn said, disgusted. Has it even occurred to you that there's more than one kind of love?
I know that, Jury replied, feeling her cheeks grow hot.
But this is none of your business, Azalin insisted. Look, I know you mean well, but if you try to help, you'll only screw things up. Stay out of this. Let the two of them work out for themselves what they are and aren't to each other. These things are delicate, but long-lived. It could take years to fully form, but it has to be allowed to form itself. You can't shape it into what you think it should be, and neither can I. It's not our place to do that. It's theirs, and theirs alone.
And what of the one who's forgotten? Jury inquired bitterly.
What makes you so sure she will be? Azalin asked.
Some day the three of them will all be together, face to face to face. Who can even guess what may happen then?
Jury snorted. Utopianist nonsense. Things like that don't happen.
Don't they? There are whole species who think it's the only way to tango, said Azalin with a wicked grin.
You told Liza Broadbank you were still deliberating on miracles, she went on, more serious. How can you decide if you go around deliberately stepping on them? Well, I've destroyed this. That must mean it could never have happened. Therefore, there are no miracles. That's typical bullshit human logic.
You Sephirians have shown so much promise. I'd hoped none of you would fall into a mental trap like that.
Jury shook her head.
It's not that I don't want to believe, she said. Why am I explaining myself to you?
People do that, Azalin replied. Come on, let's go for a walk. Down to Tortilla Sam's for fajitas. I've got all kinds of insights to share, she added wryly.
Don't you have finals tomorrow, too?
Yeah, but I don't need much sleep.
Utina returned to her room, managing not to slam its door as she had 413's, only through a supreme effort of will. Kate and Nall both watched quizzically as she entered, still snarling.
What was that all about? Nall wondered.
Jury's up on her high horse, Utina replied, throwing herself into her armchair. I guess she thinks I'm being too friendly to Corwin.
Nall crossed the room from Kate's bed in a single wingbeat, then settled in Utina's lap, looking puzzled.
That doesn't make much sense, he said.
I know it doesn't, Utina snapped. It's just Jury being a pain in the ass. She's got this idea that Himemia...
Oh, skip it, she went on, making an aggravated gesture. Jury's misreading the whole situation anyway.
She's... probably just disoriented, said Kate.
I mean, consider. She's been yanked into an alien world with no warning. That'll make anybody irritable.
She chuckled.
Look at Sayanji.
Utina took a deep breath and sighed.
Yeah, I suppose. And it's my fault she's here, too. She's probably just blowing off steam.
She shook her head. Jury's got a real problem expressing herself. She never says what she's really feeling. I wish she'd just blame me for messing up her life instead of going off on these damn tangents.
I don't think she wants to blame you, said Kate. She just needs some time to adjust.
She paused, thoughtful, as if considering whether her next thought might be treading too far on unfamiliar ground, then went on,
Somehow I get the feeling this isn't about you and Corwin at all.
Well, I should hope not, grumbled Utina. I mean, not only isn't it any of her business, but I'm not even... She gave that same open-handed gesture again.
Forget it. You're right. She's still shaky from the transition, and I'm just tired. I'll apologize in the morning for snapping at her.
Good idea, said Kate, nodding.
She put her book away, and Girls and Dragon shut off the lights and went to bed.
Tortilla Sam's was, as the name suggested, a Mexican restaurant down on Highland Street. Though Jury didn't know it, this was actually Highland Street's second restaurant to go by the name Tortilla Sam's. The original had been in an older building next door to the current location. That building had been converted back to a townhouse, and the restaurant had moved into a new building next door. Habitués of the place commonly agreed that the new site lacked character, but was more comfortable. Being so close to campus, Sam's was a common haunt for WPI students. If the staff found it a little odd to find such a student wandering into the place at 9 at night on the evening before finals, they didn't say. After all, some students had odd study habits, and as long as they were back in the dorms by curfew, there was no need to raise a fuss. Besides, only one of the two new customers was a student of the Institute. Her companion, a tall, green-eyed redhead, looked around the restaurant with cool disinterest while the Dantrovian chattered with one of the waiters and made arrangements for a table for two, non-smoking. The restaurant itself was rather open in design. A large seating area with movable plastic-covered tables, concrete floors for ease of cleaning, and high ceilings with exposed rafters. Traditional music from the Republic of Texas played over the speakers, and various rustic and colorful artifacts of late 20th century Mexico decorated the walls. Azalin smiled as she and Jury were led to their table, looking up at the wooden beams that supported the restaurant's roof. "I always like coming to this place," the short, silver-haired girl commented as she removed her coat, slinging it over the back of her chair before sitting down in it. "Oh, why is that?" Jury asked as she removed her own coat and sat down opposite Azalin. "It's part of the same reason I'm rooming in Riley," the Dantrovian replied, already looking at the plastic-covered menus that had been provided. "The high ceilings, the slight darkening up in the rafters, the spreading timbers. It reminds me of home." "Your home had a lot of cathedral ceilings?" Jury asked, while glancing over the menu as well. The meal items were unfamiliar to her, however, so she set the menu aside to study the younger girl. Azalin laughed. "That's one way of putting it, though Dantrov's got pretty high ceilings. All-you-can-eat steak fajita platter or the chicken," she mused, tapping one foreclaw against the plastic listing. "What do you think, Jury?" "I really don't have a preference, Azalin," the redhead replied, distracted, regarding the Dantrovian with her silvery gray hair and golden eyes. Her gaze drifted down Azalin's arm to study her three-fingered hand, and for the first time Jury noticed the gleaming black claw sticking out from under her right index fingernail. There was a moment's pause, and then Jury finally spoke again. "I wasn't aware you had claws, Azalin. Are they functional?" she asked, her tone more curious than challenging. "Oh, didn't anybody tell you?" Azalin said with a grin. She backed up out of her chair, kicked off her shoes, and rapidly climbed up into the rafters via a support post, gripping the wood with her unsheathed toe and finger claws. "Dantrovians are an arboreal species." Jury arched one slim tangerine eyebrow as she looked up at the Dantrovian in her new perch. "No, they somehow neglected to inform me of that," she replied, a slight bemused smile on her lips. "Not that it matters, I suppose." Azalin laughed, curled up in the rafters like a self-satisfied cat, her golden eyes glinting in the dim light. Jury, looking up at her shadowed smile, entertained a brief fantasy of the rest of the Dantrovian fading away, leaving nothing but that disembodied grin glinting down from the rafters. "I knew there was a reason I liked you," Azalin went on, her tail flicking back and forth. "Well, I'm glad that I met with some approval then," Jury replied, though her tone of voice was slightly sardonic. Azalin looked like she was about to respond, but by then the waiter returned with her chips and salsa and politely asked the copper-skinned girl to get down out of the rafters before she got hurt. Azalin mock scowled at the waiter but relented, effortlessly dropping back into her chair without disturbing the table's place settings. Jury tried to hide a bemused look and failed. Azalin winked back at her. She placed their meal and drink orders, and the waiter departed, leaving the two girls alone with the appetizers. "So," said Azalin, using a tortilla chip to scoop some salsa, "how'd you get involved in all this?" "Hmm?" replied Juri, after she had taken a bite of a chip that was similarly prepared. "I would think it'd be obvious. Tenjo yanked me from my rooms at the academy. While it was for a good cause, as that Broadbank woman certainly needed to be taught a lesson, it's left me somewhat at loose ends." Azalin shook her head. "No, that's not what I meant. I mean, Otori Academy, that sham of a tournament, all that stuff."